I want you to turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 32, verse number 27, to help set the background better for the book that we're going to next. We've been talking about the time under King Hezekiah, which would be the last part of the 700s BC. King Hezekiah was the best of all the kings of Judah. And we're talking about morally speaking here. And so in this text, we have a description of his reign with that in mind. It says, now Hezekiah had immense riches and honor. He made for himself treasuries of silver, gold, precious stones, spices, shields, and all kinds of valuable articles, storehouses also for the produce of grain, wine and oil, pens for all kinds of cattle, and sheepfolds for the flocks. And he made cities for himself and acquired flocks and herds in abundance. For God had given him very great wealth. So he was the best of the kings of southern Judah. And he amassed a lot of prosperity during his reign because of God's blessing upon his kingdom. But the other thing that we know about King Hezekiah is that he was told, when he was probably in his 30s, that he needed to put his house in order because he was going to die. He had some sort of physical ailment, an open sore, a boil, perhaps a form of cancer. And he immediately took to his bed, turned his face to the wall, and began to pray to God that he would get more time. And God had mercy on him, sent the prophet Isaiah back into that room. Isaiah had not even made it out of the palace complex yet. And he was told that he got 15 more years. Now, when you first hear that, it's like, cool, I get 15 more years. But the longer you go through that bonus period, the more you would be aware, I've only been given 15 more years. And it becomes a countdown of inevitable death. It is my opinion that this tension between thanking God for life, but being faced with the inevitability of death, weighed on Hezekiah, and he began to look for answers, for meaning. And he ends up, I think, realizing when it's all said and done that everybody dies. Nothing can be done about that. It is part of the human condition because of sin, because of the choices made at the beginning of our human history. And nothing that you do, nothing you engage in, is going to change that reality. And so you basically just have to make the most of the time you have. I believe that King Hezekiah wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, I know most people teach that it is the product of King Solomon, but I disagree. I think it fits much better with Hezekiah. One of the problems I have with Solomon being the author is that we know from the scripture that Solomon's reign ends poorly. That in the last few years of his life, he's not only taken on many wives and built up chariot forces and things like that directly against God's direction, but that when he gets challenged on those things, when he gets called on the carpet about those things, his reaction is to strike out and punish people for challenging him. He was even worshiping other gods and goddesses with his pagan wives. And so I do not see him finishing his life with the advice that we see that comes inside the book of Ecclesiastes, which is basically fear God, keep his commandments, and realize that all of us have to answer for what we do with our life. All right, so with that as background, let's turn our attention to the book of Ecclesiastes. And remember that Ecclesiastes is the name taken from the Greek Old Testament book. The name for this book should be, from the Jewish term, Koheleth, which has to do with collecting things or people. And I'll get to why I think that's important to the story as well in just one moment. So here we go. The words of the preacher. Now that word is our English Standard Version's choice. The Hebrew is Koheleth. The Greek is Ecclesiaste. And Ecclesiaste, yes, does mean someone who speaks to the assembly of those gathered in a religious assembly. But it also, we need to remember that underlying it is the Hebrew word Koheleth, which has to do with a person either calling assembly, so gathering people together, or collecting things together. Now, both Solomon and Hezekiah were collectors, were those that called assemblies. Solomon, of course, called great assemblies related to the building of the temple and its dedication. And so he called people together and prayed with them at the dedication of the temple. But he also collected other things. He collected wealth. He collected wives, unfortunately, and military things, but he also collected wisdom. Hezekiah collected the people together for the great Passover after he had refreshed the temple, reinvigorated its procedures, and he called the people together to rededicate themselves to God. So he also was a collector of people, a caller of assemblies. But we also know that he was involved in collecting wisdom, because from chapter 25 onward in the book of Proverbs, which we just finished, that was all collected together under the auspices of King Hezekiah. So I believe that we should look at this word, Koheleth here, as meaning collector or caller of assemblies. So the words of the collector, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And of course, both of those apply to either one of the two kings. Now we get to the meat of the matter. Vanity of vanities, says the collector. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Let's talk about this word vanity. It is the word hevel. It's actually the underlying word for the name of Abel in the book of Genesis. The young man that ends up being killed by his brother Cain. It's built on the idea of a puff of breath, just an exhale. And it is used in this context to mean something that doesn't have much substance to it. It doesn't have much lasting ability to it. And the way that it is constructed is that you say it once, but match it up with a plural of itself. So, a puff of breath, amidst puffs of breath, right? The ultimate idea of something without substance. So, vanity of vanity. Don't think of it as being worthless or worthwhile or something without worth. Think of it as something that is not under our control. It is outside our ability to direct how it gets used. And so everything, says the collector, is outside our control. Everything is. And then he starts to illustrate it. Verse number 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Now, I think this is another tie-in to the Hezekiah story. When he was told by Isaiah that he was going to get 15 more years, he was also told you can ask for your own supernatural sign that you're going to get this extra 15 years. And Isaiah said, do you want the shadow on the sun clock to go forward or backward miraculously? Now, sun clocks work on the idea that the sun casts a shadow as the sun moves across the sky. And you can estimate how many hours are left or have occurred in the day based on where the shadow hits on the sun clock. And you can even make adjustments for the time of year it is. And Hezekiah said, well, the shadow's always advancing. I want it to go backward, which means I want more time, right? If the shadow goes backwards on the sun clock, you're getting more time. Well, it is the sun crossing the sky that causes that shadow. And so when Hezekiah says, what does man gain by all his toil? That is his hard work every day, right? 6 days a week, at which he toils under the sun, under that timepiece that keeps going across the sky, right? Day by day, moment by moment, time just keeps moving on. And so what do we do during that time? We work. It is part of the curse, right? Now, originally, we were supposed to work with a pleasant outcome. It would be more like hobby, enjoyable work. But once sin entered the world, the curse that was brought by God against the creation caused our work to be toilsome. And so our days are not nearly as enjoyable now as they should have been. And so the question again gets asked, what does a man gain by all that hard work at which he toils day by day under the sun? Verse 4, a generation comes, and that's true. We've got new people being born, growing up, so we got a new generation coming on. And then a generation goes, so you got the ones dying ahead. So generation goes, generation comes, but the earth, the land, remains forever. Now, we know that this world is slotted for ultimate judgment and destruction. It's going to pass away with heat and noise, but it'll be replaced with the brand new heaven and earth. So this is not talking about the current earth being permanent. What it is talking about in the context here is that people come and people go, but the land they work on is still there. You know, grandpa, great-grandpa used to work these same fields that we're working right now. That would be the idea of Hezekiah and other Israelis of his day. The land is always there, needing to be worked some more. Verse number 5. The sun rises, right? The sun goes down, and then it hastens to place where it rises. So we've got sunrise, we all head off to work. sunset, we'll head off to bed. And then the sun runs around the earth and rises again on us, and we start the process all over again. That's his point. Everything just keeps moving, day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, decade by decade, century by century, millennia by millennia. It just keeps going, and it's always the same. That's his point. Verse 6, the wind blows to the north, to the south, and then it goes around to the north. Around and round it goes, the wind. On its circuits, the wind returns. So nowadays, we look at the weather on our television, or maybe we look out on our phone, and we see those satellite images of the cyclonic nature of the weather. And we know that as it comes through, the wind is going to change based on where we're at under that great big massive whirling bit of weather. Well, they experienced it at ground level and understood, yeah, the wind's blowing from the south right now. Later it's going to be blowing from the north, the west, the east, and then it's going to shift back around to the south. It's always going to be shifting around. It's not always going to be from the same direction. It's repetitive. It goes through a cycle. This next one I find very interesting. All streams run to the sea. So water always finds its level. It's always heading downhill, right? And so think about the people living in Israel. They had a whole bunch of rivers that ran westward into the Med. So all those streams are running into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. It doesn't get super, super full from all that water. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. So all that water that ends up in the Med, they understood somehow ends back up again at the beginning of the streams. Now, we know scientifically that whole idea of evaporation and condensation and precipitation and how all that water that is going down those rivers ends up in the Med, evaporates, turns into water vapor, comes back across the land, rains down on the land, gets back into the water table at the heads of all those streams, and the cycle starts all over again. They understood that something like that was going on, and that the ocean never fills up completely. It's cyclical, like life. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. So everything just kind of weighs on us when we try to understand it, right? We can't explain everything, why things are the way they are. We'd like to know more. Well, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, meaning as much as we look at stuff, our eye never gets enough, right? We always want to look a little bit more. Nor the ear filled with hearing. Our ears are constantly bringing more information into our heads. They're never full. They want more. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. So things are cyclical. Everything happens in some form or fashion over and over and over and over again. Yeah, there's some unique twists each time somebody comes up with a new way of doing something, but it's still the same something. Verse 10, is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? And then the response is, it's already been in the ages before us. You know, I point out the fact that I kind of grew up with no indoor plumbing. water had to be brought by my great-grandmother from the valley in a bucket from a stream or from a spring. And then later it was hand pumps for wells that had been dug, things like that. And then eventually, you know, we come up with electricity and start getting running water. And then we, you know, bring in indoor toilets with flush capabilities instead of using the outhouses anymore. Well, those are pretty amazing things to have. It's counted as modern society. Well, guess what? The Romans had running water. The Romans had toilets that flushed. It was a continual flush, but it was a flushing. And even before them, there were societies in, I think, Crete it was, that had similar ways of having running water in their houses and flushing toilets. So guess what? Everything has probably already happened in some form or fashion before. There is nothing new under the sun. We don't even know how advanced the society previous to the flood got before they were wiped out. So it's possible that even some of the things that we're doing right now in our high tech may have been done previously. But the ultimate point of King Hezekiah, I think, of Koholeth, the gatherer, the assembler, is that things move along in a cycle, and in that cycle, we forget what happened in the past. Verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Yeah, the written word, movable typeset, all of this has helped us to retain knowledge a lot better over time. But you know what? If we lost power on a large scale and had major fires occur, a lot of our history, a lot of our intelligence, a lot of our societal information would be gone, and we'd have to start over again. That's the reality that we live in. Now, back to the text, verse 12. I, Koholeth, the one gathering things, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart. Now remember, heart in the Hebrew mindset is all about making choices. It's your database and your moral compass working together. Okay? So he says, I've applied my heart, my thinking processes, to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And so I think this is King Hezekiah writing this down as his journal of his life crisis. When he starts looking at his ticking clock of 15 years, then 14 years, then 13 years, then 12 years, and he realizes he's going to die and there's nothing he can do about it. He starts to seek out what is the meaning of life if death is how it ends. And one of the things that he did was try to find it in the wisdom that's already out there. I think it's the reason why he grabbed a hold of the book of Proverbs and then started finding other proverbs from King Solomon, because King Solomon was a very smart guy who'd collected a lot of information during his time. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Meaning life under the curse, facing inevitable death, is not pleasant. We're supposed to work. Remember, the curse included the idea you will work until you can't work anymore. And then your body is going to be turned back to dust, because you came from dust, you're going back to dust, right? So King Hezekiah says, this is rough stuff, rough territory that God has given us. Verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, that is, in day-to-day life. And behold, all is vanity. All is insubstantive. It doesn't have any ability to hold it on to it. It's all vanity, and it's striving after wind. That's a synonymous phrase for vanity of vanities. Striving after wind. Have you ever tried to grab wind and hold on to it, shape it, stuff it in a jar? It can't be done. That's the point of life. Life is brief when compared to eternity. And we have no control over it. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight. I always like to use the example of a paperclip. How many of you, like me, have wanted to use a long metal in order to do something with it? I don't know, make it into a small hook or use it to poke on something. And so we grab a paperclip and we bend it open all the way. Have you ever tried to put it back? You can't get it done with your human fingers. What is crooked can't be made straight, and vice versa. What is lacking cannot be counted. If I were to take a whole bunch of buckets of paper clips in front of you and just throw them up in the air and they landed on the ground and I said, okay, start counting. And so you started picking up, counting them, and you got to 3,456. And I said, okay, how many are left? You wouldn't know because you don't know what the total number is to begin with. What is lacking can't be counted. Life is like that. We don't know everything about it.